I think the fire alarms are over, so I'd like to welcome you all to the panel discussion. The subject is communicating mathematics. This is a subject that was dear to Bill Thurston's heart. He wrote this article on proof and progress in mathematics, which you all have probably looked at. And there's a subsection entitled Communicating Mathematics. And what he says is the transfer of understanding from one person to another is not automatic. It is hard and tricky. So today we have a very distinguished panel of mathematicians who've wrestled with this problem. And so I'd like to begin by having them introduce themselves one by one and say a little bit about the types of experience they've had communicating mathematics to other people.
Hi, I'm Steve Strogatz. I'm an applied mathematician here at Cornell. And most of the work I do in terms of research is applications of dynamical systems to things like physics or biology or social science. It's about 10 years that I've been trying to communicate with the public about the beauty of our subject and the importance of it. So I've written a few books aimed at the public, been on the radio, on a show called Radio Lab or Science Friday. And a few years ago, I had a series of columns in the New York Times.
Ben Safar, but from the University of Chicago. And other than the experiences that are shared by probably most people in the room of colloquia and seminars and stuff, I've had the challenge of giving math circles to seventh graders, which is the hardest by far. I give a good deal of public talks, whether it's to like rich donors or alumni. I've given this Cafe Ciel Tafik, which is a worldwide kind of thing that just started in the States, where you go to a pub and you talk to people. And I had the challenge of giving a commencement address in the physical sciences at University of Chicago. And so these are different kinds of challenges. I give a lot of colloquia. And I guess I would say too, I spent a lot of time at the graduate student level, both when I was a grad student, but trying to especially like write books and communicate, making it easier for graduate students to jump into areas and to explain things.
My name is Etienne Gis, I'm from France. I also participated a lot to public lectures, but in the last 5 to 10 years, I've been very interested by communication. One, I began 5 years ago an online journal called Image de Mathématique, whose purpose is precisely to communicate mathematics from inside of mathematics to outside mathematics. Another thing I did was producing two movies, animation movies. I was very happy with that because we had several million downloads, one on dimensions and one on chaos theory. And recent experience is that now I'm a columnist in the Le Monde journal.
Wow. Yeah. My name is Jeff Weeks. My favorite audience for lectures is a public lecture. And I also do some lecturing at the undergraduate talks and for departmental colloquia. That's sort of half of what I do. The other half is developing software to present mathematical ideas to the general public. And stuff like the Torus Games, which some of you might have seen last night, program Collidipate on an iPad. So it's used mostly by artists to draw pictures. You draw with your finger and it fills out the whole wallpaper pattern for you as you draw. So that sort of stuff.
Hi, I'm Kurt McMullen. I'm at Harvard via upstate Vermont, and I work on Riemann surfaces and moduli spaces and other topics central to this conference. My first math talk was in 1980 when I was an undergraduate. It was on a problem by Basakovich called Lion and Man. So we have a lion and man confined to a circular arena. They both have the same top speed, and the question is what strategy the lion should pursue to catch the man. This is how it was posed by Littlewood, which is a hint that in fact the man can evade the lion forever. It depends on the fact that the sum of 1 over n diverges, but the sum of 1 over n squared converges. Anyway, I learned how to teach by tutoring undergraduates at Stanford in what was supposed to be calculus, but usually what we talked about was adding fractions correctly. and so since then, I've taught at all levels and taught, you know, mathematical communication is going everywhere from one-on-one to giving public lectures to giving colloquia to trying to teach 600 undergraduates at once with a microphone and a projector. And I have almost no interaction with the media, unlike the more noted members of the audience, except that there's a course called Math 55 at Harvard, which is the hardest freshman math course in the world. And it used to be that people were sort of slowly kicked out of it as they showed they didn't have the mettle to handle it. And I was approached by Canadian television who wanted to do a reality TV show that would be sort of modeled on Survivor. unfortunately, this didn't materialize, and actually I had changed the class to try to keep people on the island rather than kick them off. anyway, that's who I am.
Okay, well, thank you all. The last part of Bill's quote was, it's hard and tricky to communicate mathematics. Well, mathematics itself is hard and tricky, and we're all trained to do that. Why should a mathematician who's not specifically trained to communicate, why should they invest time and effort learning to communicate well with audiences, possibly taking time away, in fact, from the amount of time they have to actually produce mathematics? Does anybody want to take that?
I'm sure all of us can give many different reasons, and we probably will agree on all the reasons, but I wanted to quote Hilbert. When Hilbert gave his famous talk in Paris in 1900, you know, it was a list of open questions that we all know. Almost nobody read the introduction to this paper. And in the introduction, he explains something that I believe is very interesting. He says that a mathematical theory cannot be considered understood unless, until you can explain it to the man in the street. So my first answer to your question is that it's very useful for yourself. If you want to understand deeply what you are doing, the best way is to explain it to somebody else. So this is my first motivation. It's very egocentric.
I think another way to look at this is that society as a whole supports us all. So in this sense, we have kind of a moral obligation to report back what we learn to the people who are supporting us. So, I mean that in two senses, on the practical level for engineering applications, but also on a cultural level to report back sort of the joy and excitement of mathematics.
Okay, so Karen sent me this question. I was kind of puzzled by what the answer could possibly be. There's a more basic question, which is, why are we spending our time doing mathematics, let alone communicating? And I'll give a quote, as you did, which Lippmann Mayers passed on to me. He said, mathematics is something we do for the begrudging admiration of a few close friends. Another way to say this is that, like as you said, is that mathematics is something where a lot of the reward is personal. And if you're not personally rewarded by doing mathematics, you probably shouldn't, because the external rewards will be minimal. And unfortunately, the same thing is true with communication. Communication, giving a successful lecture, having a successful conversation one-on-one with another person, especially a non-mathematician, is very rewarding
for the two of you. Teaching well once you have tenure is not going to advance your career. And in fact, it may hold it back. And it's very unfortunate that communication is not valued as highly as research, nearly as highly within our community. And so, but my answer is, it's always gratifying to do something well. And we have constant opportunities to communicate, whether we're teaching, whether we're giving a colloquium. And it's always gratifying to try to do it well.
I think it's interesting because the answers I wrote down for this to remind myself were also somewhat selfish. I learn about my own stuff if I'm forced to. It focuses my thinking. And also, you know, part of the answer is, why do humans communicate at all? You don't need to communicate nearly as much as you do just to survive. Especially me, I don't know. But it's gratifying, the one-on-one conversations. You know, I gave a talk yesterday, and it's incredibly gratifying, just fun. Just talking math with people. But I usually learn because there's that question in the audience. The number of times, even when I'm giving a colloquium, and someone asks the question, I mean, you know, most colloquia, this doesn't happen. But it just has to happen a few times. Someone asks a question, and I hadn't thought about things that way, and it alters the course of my research. For me, I'm pretty selfish. I'm doing this, I want to grow intellectually, grow mathematically, and this helps a lot. Like, individual conversations have changed my mathematical life. And but one other thing I just want to say is that I do think we're doing this for the, I actually believe what I'm about to say, to further human knowledge. And things are lost. You know, Gauss was great, but he's nothing without us, right? He's nothing without us. And things really will be lost. And this was true with Thurston probably more than any other mathematician. Who he was and his way of thinking was transmitted to some extent in his papers, but so much more through the people in the Thurston School. And I talk with Danny Caligari about this all the time, because he was a Thurstonian, even though he wasn't a student. And it's so funny, you sort of look at it, there are people who don't view math this way. I mean, somehow the Thurstonian way, it's like you're encountering the math and everything else is just symbol pushing. And so it's transmitting that to the next generation, which of course we're like barking dogs trying to transmit Bach. You know, Thurston was like Bach, and I had to learn, you know, then learning it from Kurt, it's like going through the barking dog, so it's still Bach. It's still Bach, and you know, it's getting a lot, so that's unfortunate. It's too, yeah, we should have more videos of Bill. It's not caught with video, I have to say, there's some videos of Bill lecturing, they're not particularly great moments for Bill. I mean, you know, I'm saying, so it's like really lost. It's sort of lost when Bill dies. That's lost. Although it lives through us, all of us.
Can I add one sentence? Just a quick Thurston quote. Bill once said that mathematics is an oral culture.
Well, hearing people talking about how gratifying it is, I certainly would agree with that. But there's a related word I would want to mention here, which is gratitude. That is, I find. Well, like when I was asked by the New York Times to write these articles for them, it was very unclear whether the public would have any interest. It's not normal to see math written about in the newspaper, and for 15 weeks you'd think, does the public really have any patience for this, and are they going to want to read this? And we didn't know, but the overwhelming reaction to this was thanks, that people would write in with all kinds of expressions of gratitude for being given a second chance. I mean, you have to recognize, maybe you do, because of course when we teach people we see this, or if you talk to your relatives or your non-mathematical friends, that people have all kinds of phobias and traumas about what we did to them. So for many people, there's a desire to have a second chance, especially as they get older and they hear us going on, I mean, if they do, about how elegant it is or how beautiful or joyful, and they know they're missing something. Just like, you know, right now, World Cup is happening. I don't get it, okay? I don't know about soccer, never really paid attention to soccer. I know I'm missing something great by not understanding or appreciating soccer. So I'm left out, and I think people are left out of math in the same way, that we could share this fantastic thing with them, and if you open the door for them, they're grateful. So that does feel good.
Could I also just add one comment? I also have people discuss sometimes, what is math? And there's Platonists who believe that math exists in this ideal world and that we're kind of reaching and examining that world. And then there's solipsists who believe that math is stuck inside their own head and that they're experiencing that beautiful reality with their eyes closed. But for me, math only exists at that moment when it's communicated from one person to another. It doesn't exist in the individuals, it exists in the edges that connect the vertices.
About the two sentences.
Let's get higher connectivity here. Okay, so given then that it's a worthwhile something to do, you guys have all been had a lot of experience communicating with audiences. So I had the next question I sent out to these guys was, what techniques have they found to be effective with an audience? How do they vary with different types of audiences? And have the talks changed over the years? And if so, how? So would anyone like to take that one?
On that question, Karen, I did have an immediate reaction based on this article that Kurt mentioned earlier, you know, Bill's Proof and Progress in Math, where he makes the point somewhere in the article that when we talk to each other one-on-one, like imagine you're talking to someone outside your field, and you're going to try another mathematician, and you're explaining to them sort of what the key problems are, why they're interesting. You use a certain voice and style, and also body language, and modulation, and all kinds of things that help the communication go. But when you give a colloquium, or God forbid a seminar, you don't do those same things. That is, I think we would all agree that it's much easier to learn math from your friend than from going to a seminar. And so I feel like a key principle in communication is to think of yourself as the listener's friend. That if you don't think I'm trying to be clear or I'm trying to impart knowledge, those are kind of very disembodied, cold things. If you just think, this is my friend who wants to understand, I want my friend to understand, and I want this to be fun, and both of us have a good time and not suffer too much, etc. If you really put it in your mind that this is my friend, I'm going to empathize, I'm going to be sweet, I'm going to try to think of what my friend is interested in and connect to my friend through that thing. Like if this is a person who likes sports, I'll tie math to sports. Or if they like philosophy, I'll get into the philosophy. If they're slow, I'll go slow. You know, etc. If you really think of this person as your friend, and of course it's difficult because there is no person there. This is some unimagined, I mean, it's a vague thing. It's this audience, the man in the street, the term was used when you mentioned Hilbert. You don't know who you're picturing, so it is tough.
There's a famous example, which is well known among French journalists, at least. In the 1960s, on television, there was the first scientific program by and he was speaking so well, people said, how do you do? And he said, I speak to my garage.
So to my mechanic.
So he wanted to speak to somebody very explicit. And this is a good idea.
Grinfeld to my mechanic. I have a comment to what Steve was saying. I mean, one thing is it's supposed to be about the audience and not you. And the hardest thing for me, and I think for a lot of people, is to put yourself in the shoes of the audience. And one thing that's changed with me over time, the level of my talks in terms of the sophistication of the material has gone down, unfortunately, linearly. And I keep realizing I'm talking at twice the level, and I think, okay, now it's really basic. And then I think when I'm in the audience, you know. So that's why also, to engage people, to tell a story, it's so much more interesting. But I just think, if I had to say one, you know, there's infinitely many smaller things to say about talks, but just putting yourself in the audience, remembering it's about them and not you. I learned this from this, I had the opportunity to do this great workshop with actually the actor Alan Alda, and this guy was like producer of 60 Minutes, and these are super professional communicators. And all these things they said were these amazing revelations to me, and I thought I knew how to give talks, and I realized I just did this a year ago, and I like, know nothing. I mean, but they really, these are professionals, so, yeah. Anyway, but that was their big advice.
Can I continue on the same theme that when I first started giving talks, I think my mental model was to take some piece of mathematics that I wanted to convey, think about it as carefully as I could, and try to find the simplest and clearest way to explain it and go with that. Yeah. And the results were often almost always disappointing. So I need to use both hands here. Can you still hear me if I put the mic down?
I'll hold it.
Oh, okay, thanks. Okay, so I think a much better mental model, at least for me, is you think of the space of all possible mental states. Before you even get to your math, think about your audience and try to imagine where they're at, what ideas they're comfortable with, sort of how they look at the world, and then think about the piece of mathematics that you want to convey. And then as you make your lecture, you think, okay, how am I going to build a bridge from here to here? So for me, that's the main principle, is just thinking how to build a bridge from one mental state to another.
I wanted to add something. Of course, speaking one-to-one is fantastic. Giving talks in front of an audience is fantastic. But this is less efficient than using internet. I think internet is the word. I mean, with internet, we can reach people that would not come to your talks. And I can tell you that when we produced this movie with, I told you, millions of downloads, receiving emails from kids from the middle of China is so rewarding, and they would never come to my talks. So it is clear that we have to improve our communication level in talks. But we, I believe, have to be very careful in the way we are using the internet. For example, we are now filmed. I think we should be much more careful the way we film talks. Usually, you know, a fixed camera and will be put on the internet this way is terrible. It's just terrible. Sorry. So what I wanted to stress is that it is fundamental that we edit the films that we produce. And this is hard work. And when we organize such a meeting, for example, we should maybe select one or two talks and give a hard work on these talks to produce a wonderful object that will be viewed all over the planet, instead of putting thousands of talks that nobody would look at. So again, I'm convinced that I love speaking to human beings, but in terms of efficiency, we have to use the internet in a clever way.
This is something that I might not say anything coherent here, because in my mind I hold, in fact for a few years I've held two very contradictory thoughts, that on the one hand, for me, live interaction with human beings is something irreplaceable, not just between the speaker and the audience, but with the audience amongst themselves. I think there's something very fundamentally social about human beings, that we like to get together in groups and share these experiences in the flesh. And at the same time, though, I completely understand this argument that we can reach millions of people by doing these things well. And so I guess part of what I want to say is I haven't reconciled these two approaches. And the other part is I don't really know how to do the internet stuff. So a question I'd like to ask the other panelists or anybody is how one would get started in this, like if you just don't even know where to begin.
Okay, so I can answer that. So, like Etienne, I agree that most math talks are on occasion filmed in a less than optimal fashion. I had a great opportunity at Harvard right after Perlman had proved the Poincaré conjecture to give a big public lecture. It was filmed with four cameras. It was very professionally edited. And a few years later, I got an email from somebody in Georgia who wanted to show it to their class, and couldn't find it, or they didn't have access. And my 12-year-old son explained to me how you use YouTube. And the way you use YouTube is you take your video and you drag it to where it says upload. And then it gives you a URL and you email that to anyone who wants to watch it. And immediately it's available around the world. And I can't believe that this is not used every day. I mean, it's a trivial thing to do with any material. So you know, whenever you see something that you like that's not generally available, you can make it available to everyone immediately using YouTube. Okay, so the question was general techniques for communication and how to improve communication. I want to try to disavow participation in negative comments. I'm going to quote Bill instead. So I think I was the only person on the panel who was present at the Berkeley faculty meeting right after Bill had written his paper, and he gave a little talk on it. He said, started by saying, most mathematical communication is dysfunctional. And he went on to describe how papers are dysfunctional, how one-on-one communication is dysfunctional, how people pretend to lecture, the audience pretends to listen. And after he said this, Rob Kirby, unnamed Berkeley mathematician, and said, I don't know, Bill, I think we do a pretty good job, you know, teaching calculus and stuff. And Bill turned around and he wrote, that reminds me, and he wrote on the blackboard, denial. And so I think one thing that I think would be very helpful in furthering and improving mathematical communication is to not participate in denial. Okay, so let me just say just a few words about communicating. So, and I view this panel to be very broad, to include writing papers, to include one-on-one discussion. For example, writing papers, people often write as if they are writing a legal defense of their proposition, you know, that will stand up against a prosecutor or something. And you're not doing that. You're writing, your potential reader will probably have an IQ of at least 140, will be a mathematician themselves, and what they will do is they will try to decode what you wrote and turn it back into a mathematical argument that they can understand. So why not try to cut out this intermediate encoding, decoding step? I think this is a problem in a lot of papers. And my model, absolutely, my thesis advisor is Dennis Sullivan. Sometimes he goes too far, but he almost always goes directly to the idea rather than the details. Another obvious thing for giving talks, and it applies just as well to teaching as to lectures in the public, tell a story. Always tell a story. Lie. Lying helps so much, and I mean, you know, we know when we may have made a false statement. Go ahead and do it. It usually makes it easier to explain things. Don't be afraid to say, actually, I should assume p is not equal to 2, and it just... let's see. Okay, so before you give a talk, you should always write notes, but you should never look at them. I use them only as a security blanket. You know, don't write a formula on your notes and then copy it onto the board as if the students are supposed to be able to derive it when you couldn't even derive it yourself on the board. And another thing I just want to mention is to give a good talk or give a good lecture, you have to take seriously the idea that that's what you want to do. And it's going to be hard. So either decide to do it or don't. But if you decide you want to make it good, accept the fact that, like, you might want to add a figure to your paper. It might take you a week to draw that figure. And you'll learn a lot doing it, but I mean, it's worth it. And just make the decision that you're going to commit to doing it.
Yeah,
I also think... two more things. I also
think... We're going to interrupt.
When you give a talk, so we often talk more than once on the same topic. Always change something. There's nothing worse than giving a talk and having this sense of deja vu, and then, like, you're dissociated from the talk. You lose who you are. For example, I like to give my talks backwards now and then, just to
rest them up. Or randomly.
Or randomly. And there's one final thing I want to say is that, as a barking dog trying to channel Bach, one thing barking dogs, all dogs have, or that not they bark,
his extraordinary sensitivity to unspoken, unspeaking other animals around him.
The other dogs.
To the other dogs. And you can sense when you're giving a talk, when you're giving a talk one-on-one, when you're teaching, if you pay attention, you can sense exactly where your audience is. And you should listen to that. That's something we all have built into us as human beings. And let that guide your talk. And then there's one more thing that I wanted to say, and that will be the last thing. And what is it? Who can tell me? Rick.
Sorry, it wasn't me. One interpretation.
Thank you. Always do not be afraid to ask questions of the audience. That's, it wakes them up and engages them.
I think that's a big, in the engaging, we both said tell a story. It's really about engagement. When you go to talks, and I've been to talks to friends in the business world, I've not got to enough to do this, but I've thought about it. In the business world, before talks, they have music playing, and in the audience, you're getting really pumped up to music. And then you're ready to engage. And I'd love to do that in math, because math talks, how many people have paid attention completely to any single talk here? Raise your hand. Okay. I didn't pay attention to one. No, it's really tough. See, just continue engaging. But I just want to say, I mean, I have lots of very specific things, you know, people are visual, give pictures. But as general meta advice, two things. One thing I learned from a mathematician, I'll name him, it's CM, he's a field medalist, I mean, the initials are CM. Like, why you give such great talks, and over time, I realized this guy just works 10 times harder than I, he's no better than me in giving talks. But he works incredibly hard to make it seem really easy, and I heard this about Milner. His book and stuff, it's so clean and easy looking, because it's the opposite. He's working incredibly hard, and there's no way around it. To give a great talk, there's no way around just working super hard and finally coming to terms with that.
Let me try to boil it down to my one single bit of advice. It's close to something Kurt said about, actually, let me not even refer to Kurt. The advice would be, help the audience love the question. I mean, what I'm thinking of is when Kurt mentions that we write in this legalistic way, as if we're imagining an antagonist, that we have to be very correct. We're worried. I mean, of course, that's our culture, right? We don't want to say anything false. In communicating, I think a key thing is not so much to be focused on getting the answer right. It's to convey the beauty and importance of the question. It's to convey why you love this question. Why did you spend all this time? Or why does your community of fellow mathematicians, like, why do we care about the Poincaré conjecture? I haven't seen your talk about that. Now that I know it's on YouTube, I'm gonna look that up. But, I mean, I hope that you would have spent a fair amount of time on what we call motivation. And that's what's so sorely lacking in many of our papers and seminars. Where, you know, we know that we're supposed to do it, but there's this sick culture, but if you say Bill called it dysfunctional, I agree, that somehow we've done this thing where we can now just begin, you know, let G be a finite group. That's not motivation. I want something that tells me why I'm gonna care about this paper. And don't tell me that it's because math is hard. I mean, yes, it's hard, but so is theoretical physics, and the theoretical physicists have a different culture. When you go to their colloquia, they give you the motivation. I mean, they try. Many of us don't try, and it's just not excusable. I'm sorry, this is not where Karen thought this was going. This was supposed to be about communicating with the public, but I sort of think if we could communicate with each other better, that would really help.
I just want to say one thing. Sorry, I think now think that the one meta advice that really hit home with me, I always say, it was the word denial.
Yeah.
I always say, and this is the hardest thing in doing research for me, in doing research and in giving talks, is to look at myself in the mirror and say, would I like this talk? When I've done that to some of my talks, at the end, I'm like, you know, I wouldn't like that talk if I were in the audience.
Yeah.
And you'll get it right if you at least jump over the bar that, would I like this? Would I understand this talk? Well, you know, that's a really good start. And I think most of us don't actually get over that bar usually, don't ask that question, but it's hard to look at yourself in the mirror. That's the problem. You can deceive yourself.
A quick follow-up on that, and it's hard to look at yourself, but one thing that's really useful, what I did is the first, say, two or three times I give a talk, afterwards I'll, in private, talk with one of my friends who's there and say, okay, how can this be made better for next time? You have to phrase the question very carefully, because if you just say, hey, Ken, how do you like the talk today? The answer is, oh, yeah, it's great. And you don't learn anything useful. So you have to phrase the question, what can I, I'm going to be giving this talk again next month. What can I do to make it better and make it useful information?
It could be good to ask that before the talk, actually. I did that before my talk. I asked a friend to look through, and they're like, nope, you got to cut that, that, and that. And I'm like, oh, my God, you're right.
Okay.
So I asked my wife. So I wanted to add something. Bad talks, sometimes the speaker is not responsible for that. Who is responsible is the organizer of the meeting. What I mean is this. It should be collaboration between the organizer and the speaker, much in advance, so that the speaker should have a clear idea of who would be in the room. Usually it is very difficult to have an idea, maybe not here today, because I know who would be in such a meeting. But when you go to a general audience talk, public lecture, or whatever, you don't know who would be there. For example, yesterday night, Jeff was in front of a mixed audience, half of PhDs in mathematics and half of kids. And it's very difficult for him to handle this situation. Of course, I think he guessed that in advance, you knew that. But the half part of the audience who was kids, probably sons of PhDs in mathematics. Or maybe not in mathematics, but sons of academics, let's say. Anyway, so many times I try when I give a public lecture to discuss with the organizer to get an idea of who will come. And usually the organizer will deny this information. Because this is a hard work for them. And my general idea is that this should be a collaboration between the speaker and the organizer. This is hard work. And usually this hard work is not done.
Can I?
Yeah, Kara.
I just want to follow up on this a slightly different way in which mathematical organization and the way our community is structured is encouraging problems of communication and it has to be for organization. And one of the problems is we reward great research by giving somebody the opportunity to give a talk, a once-in-a-lifetime talk to a huge audience. For example, a plenary lecture at the ICM. Now, the person who's giving the plenary lecture at the ICM is not being rewarded for being a great communicator. Why are they being chosen to have this opportunity to talk to 3,000 people? In fact, why not designate a second person to talk on their work to these 3,000 people, and then the person being lauded could be lauded even more directly, since the person who's speaking on their own work has to be modest. And moreover, it would share the acclaim. They'd say, not, I heard this great breakthrough by X, but I heard a great talk by Y on the breakthrough by X. And the only place this is done well is in seminar Borbaki. Is the only person who organizes this correctly is someone who doesn't even exist.
I do want to make a comment on that. Now, it's definitely tough to do when you're younger. I remember, though, I gave a talk at the West Coast Topology Festival or something, Southern California. And I was ready to give a talk on the stuff I've been working on, and I had just been talking to Danny Caligari. And he said, boy, you've been explaining the work of Dennis Johnson. I'd spent years understanding this beautiful, amazing work of Dennis Johnson. And he said, that's so great, why don't you just tell us about that? And 2 minutes before my talk, I just decided to close my computer and let go of my ego, which is so hard to do, and talk about the work of Dennis Johnson. Danny afterwards said, like, actually, I hope, Danny, are you here? He said, that was the best talk you'd ever seen, even better than Kurt's talks. And the thing is, I realized, like, I enjoyed that talk, and my value added, I'm sorry.
It's all true.
My value added was, and this is for a lot of us, we spend, again, is like this, we spend a lot of our time, what is my value added to math? Yeah, I had some theorems on Johnson, after Johnson. They're nowhere near as good as my years spent understanding, and I have this point of view towards Dennis Johnson's work, and he's not around anymore, and I really understand it. That's worth so much more than what I proved, I hate to say. Don't tell the NSF. But we're not rewarded. I think in France or Europe, you can tell, like, you're rewarded more for this kind of understanding of people's work. Here, basically, if you're young, you can't do that. You should just talk about your own. No, I mean, you should combine them, but you have to impress. Because otherwise you won't get a job. I mean, this is the problem. I don't know what to do about it. But it's worth so much more doing what you said.
Just one other reaction to this line of discussion. Isn't it true that the Abel Prize has usually someone who's a good communicator along the lines of Tim Gowers or Jordan Ellenberg, you know, trying to write about what the laureate did? And I thought those have been pretty successful.
Maybe I can say something about that, because I received an email from the Abel Prize committee 2 weeks before. You received the same one. 2 weeks before the announcement of the Abel Prize winner, asking me to talk on the winner. And I said, who is he? He said, we cannot tell you. So I said, no, maybe they sent the same message to you earlier or after, I don't know.
So I'd like to interrupt this conversation now, because we would like to leave a little time to ask for questions for these guys from the audience. This is your chance. You can ask these guys anything. Tara.
So my question would be if the panel could speak to communications with politicians. Because it seems to me that this conversation presupposes that we already have jobs and grants, so that we can go and talk to each other. But I think one thing that we're really facing as a community right now is convincing political bodies to keep giving us that money.
So the question is, she wants the panel to address the topic of communicating with politicians.
I'll just jump in for 1 second. At this workshop I went to with Alan Olove, the other people, most of those people were very distinguished people who actually speak before Congress. And Alan Olove started out and said, first you have to know who you're talking to. So he puts up a video, there's a guy who's obviously in Congress, and he's giving a talk and he says, evolution and the Big Bang Theory are lies straight from the pit of hell. And Alan Alda said, this is Congressman so-and-so who is head of the Science Funding Committee. That's the challenge. I don't know what the, I mean, that's all I love it, but I love it. So you're screwed, basically.
I'd like to make a comment about this. I've actually tried to talk to politicians. In fact, I've talked to the head of the Division of Math Sciences. He said, give me someone to talk to. He said, thank you, but no. And so it's, I don't know why. I suspect it's partly because of denial. That is, the NSF is not portraying mathematics realistically to Congress, because they think if they portray it realistically, it will not sell as well. And this is partly our fault. We need a Higgs particle. We need to say, we are en route to discovering the God particle. If you just give us $100 billion, we will find it. And it's partly our fault. But I'd like to make a second remark, which is, I just got an email, as many of you may have, where I learned that Mark Zuckerberg and his colleagues have just, you know, given out $15 million in prizes to 5 great mathematicians. However, and I think more and more private organizations will be playing a role in the funding of mathematicians. What we have to communicate to these, you know, people who are sitting on their internet billions is that if they took one of those millions
And they split it into 20 pieces, each of which was $50,000, and gave it as summer support to 20 people who are not receiving any NSF summer support right now. The effect would be enormous, and it would be a ripple effect. It would be much better than giving $3 million.
No, they split it into 200 pieces
and
gave
$5,000. Yes, okay. Yeah, exactly.
The problem is, and I do a bunch of fundraising for Chicago. They always trot me out. It's just because relative to my colleagues, I look at the other person's shoes and they... But the problem is, when you're selling it, saying, for example, we want to be the best department in the world, and if you give us these professorships, nobody cares. They want to, like, transform things. And it's not sexy and obviously transformative to give grants to... I'm just saying, I completely 100% agree. If I had to spend the money, that's what I would do. I take it away from Kurt and give it to like 20 But one problem is, and I think this is a problem in Congress that the NSF faces, that why they're constantly changing, like personal grants were always incredibly successful, but the amount of personal grant money has dwindled while big institutes have gotten more money. And it's because you have to sell something as being transformative, people have to understand that it's transformative. And I think that's a hard thing that Kurt said. Maybe, you know, I don't know.
So I'd like to say something. I'm the moderator, I'm not supposed to particularly, but I want to say something in response to Kurt about how do you find someone in politics to talk to. And the answer is you don't go to Washington and ask the NSF for who to talk to. You go to your local congressman. And you won't talk to your congressman, you'll talk to his aide. And he'll report to the congressman, and you have to do that over and over again and establish a relationship. So this is advice I got from Sam Rankin, who's the AMS public, our face in Washington. And this, people have been doing this, and this works. So you need to go to your guy in Cambridge. Okay. Do we have another question, Mark?
Most of us down in the trenches do most of our lecturing to students and subsequently giving them a grade. No one had to show up for Jeff's lecture last night, but at the Naval Academy, they sure have to show up for class. In the mid-1970s, the word weenie was invented for students who care more about what's going to be on the next test than about the subject matter. I'd like to know if the panelists think that this is a bad thing or whether this is a necessary thing and how to combat it.
Actually, I often say if you put the effort into understanding it, you'll do way better on the test. In other words, not to understand it just enough for the test, but like live with it. Live it and breathe it. Then you don't even have to study and everything is trivial. I promise them this. Because, you know, we've all had it both ways. Where I've had it, when I was in Karen's course, I was just trying to learn it for the test, but I didn't do it. No, but things where I'm just like, I just care about the math. Of course the tests end up being easy. So I do think if you can convince people of that. But I don't think anything's wrong with saying like, yep, you're gonna have a grade. I mean, as long as it gets the job done of understanding. Yeah.
So, I'd like to ask a question, I will ask one of the questions Karen sent us that she didn't get to, which is the role of technology in communication, especially in giving talks. When I was 10 years old or so, I was interested in geology, and I recently looked up the Mohs scale, which is the scale of hardness. And it starts out with talc, which is like talc powder, which is a 1, and it goes down to diamond, which is a 10. Okay, so these are the scales of hardnesses of minerals, and gypsum is 2, and feldspar is 5, and slate is about 4. And I think the best way of communicating mathematics is to take a soft stone and rub it against a somewhat harder stone, especially a granular one, and spontaneously make marks on this large flat stone. And I don't think we've actually come up with a better method of communicating mathematics to an audience than that. And I say this in part because I grew up in a time when if I was going to give a talk, a very, you know, significant talk, say IGS, on Tuesday, I would prepare the talk on Monday night. And if it was an hour talk, I would spend half an hour preparing it. And now, I need to spend a week preparing the slides for the talk. And I am just torn about what to do. Slide talks can be great. Blackboard talks can be great in a different way. But I think all the panelists should have something to say about this, and I'd love to hear what they have to say. Jeff.
Okay. Certainly for one-on-one discussion, blackboards are great. For a lot of talks with a big audience, blackboards are great because you do have that flexibility to change what you're doing as you go along. On the other hand, especially with a large audience talk, if you have only 50 minutes, say, it seems like kind of a waste of time if you need to put some statement up that you're laboriously copying it out, whereas you could be using your time to bang, next slide, and then interact with the audience verbally, saying, okay, what does this mean? Where are we going with it? And save the writing it out step. So in that sense, I like having stuff prepared, bang, it's there. And then, of course, the other thing, which is almost obvious, for doing geometry, that having animations and other graphics is irreplaceable. So.
I, of course, agree with Jeff, but I wanted to add something. We all use Beaver.
No, we don't. Most of
Beaver. But recently, I discovered a new software called Prezi. Do you know that?
Say it again.
Prezi. P-R-E-Z-I. It's. I think it's fascinating. I want to use it. Instead of producing a linear set of slides, it's producing a huge slide, much, much bigger than the screen. And the speaker is just wandering in his big slide. So he can choose the path that he's following during his talk. And the audience has the feeling that the talk is not prepared in advance. I mean, it's not fully finished in advance. And the talk will lose its linear aspect, which is what we hate in Beamer. So I want to. Unfortunately, it's not a free.
Not freeware.
It's not freeware. So, but this is a very good idea.
A free way to do this. In fact, this is what I do with all my talks: is make the slides in HTML, so you can have links. I don't know whether anybody noticed last night, but there was some fine print up at the top, and that gives you options in real time to follow one path or another.
Well, you can do that in Beamer. I use that tool. Invisible buttons.
Yeah.
I press this invisible button, and the talk is different.
I have to say, I think Kurt is a hopeless romantic on Blackboard talks. But I think the reason why the sentiment, which I've had the sentiment, but the real reason I think that we all feel like, oh, Blackboard talks are better, is because it's so easy and so dangerous to go too fast in a slide talk. And that's absolutely dangerous. But if you can get around that, which by the way is so hard, I keep cutting my talks in half and thinking, now I'm not going too fast, but it's different. But I think I've seen, in fact, talks by Kurt, where it's a great slide talk. I think you need to be visual, people are visual. I realized even instead of writing Frobenius going from this to this, I just like drew a picture of a variety or I copied from the internet. I dragged a picture of a variety and written arrow, and you like, didn't you feel it more like that? You absorb it and we're visual and it's more exciting. And when I see Rick Canyon.
Some mathematicians are not like that.
Rick Canyon studying this dynamical system, yes, it's not alive to me. If he's doing symbols, but when he does the animation, it's like, I'm studying this beautiful thing.
There's several people in the audience who still want to talk. I think we should.
Okay, black shirt there.
So one way that we communicate mathematical ideas and our own understanding of them is through talking. Another way, especially with our students, is by asking them to do things. Could you talk about that, both with your own students and perhaps with a wider audience? how asking someone to do mathematics in order to communicate mathematics to them works.
I can say something quickly. So here's a recent experience I had. So Benson Farr sent me an email, asked me a question, and I sent him back three exercises to do. And his first reaction was he was completely offended. I mean, I don't even want to, I can't repeat the words he used. His wife related them to me. And we're kind of afraid to do that, right? To say, you know, if you want to really learn this, here's three easy exercises, and by the time you've done that, you will learn much more than you will if I explain it. So if we can get
to how it ended. Say how it ended.
Yeah, you say how it ended.
Okay. At first, what actually happened is I sort of ignored that, and I just kept the conversation going, and Kurt said, are you going to do those exercises or not? And I thought, it has a little moral authority over me. So I did the exercises. There were three exercises in complex analysis. Because I was a guest, and it was absolutely transformative for me. And he wouldn't answer my question. He made me do the exercise. And it was pretty fancy about boundary values and the boundary of Teichmuller space and all
that.
It was transformative, and he's like, no, just do the unit disk. And it changed me, and I'll just say this. I realized now I knew enough to answer them, but I didn't know enough to ask them. This is why you're better than me, man. But it was great. It was so effective.
So, over here.
Yeah, so one thing was mentioned in the introduction, Benson mentioned math circles, and in working with Chicago math circles, I found that it's as much communicating with the sixth graders as it is communicating with the sixth grade teachers, but I'm a lot worse at the second one. Maybe y'all have some comments on that, and how we communicate with our K-12 counterparts as they feed the next generation. And I'm here despite the ones who taught me.
In France, we have something called la main à la pâte. I think it's hands-on in English. So the idea is that you don't go to school, but you discuss with the teacher. This is really, I participated to this kind of thing. This is really fascinating, because typically a French teacher in primary school has no knowledge at all in mathematics. And usually the law. They love doing mathematics, so I think you're right. And discussing with teachers is a thing to do.
Yeah, I think it's not really that hard. It does take the time to go to your local middle school or high school and meet the people. They have math clubs, or I mean, I've been invited here and there to towns around here, and I do go. And the teachers are very grateful, so are the students, but especially the teachers. And I'm surprised at how few mathematicians are on Twitter. I don't know about Facebook, but I have found that Twitter is a really nice way to meet K-12 teachers. I mean, meet virtually. But actually, I've become so friendly with some of them, including Justin, who asked a question a few minutes ago, that we have get-togethers when I'm in New York. I meet these Brooklyn school teachers that I know through Twitter. We just hang out and talk about pedagogical things. So it is quite possible but it's the question is right, that there is this big gulf between teachers at different levels, and I think there doesn't need to be.
So we're officially out of time. There's a lot of people still with questions. Would people like to extend this for another 10 minutes? Yes. Anyone who's like to leave is welcome to. Except for the panelists. Sorry?
Would you just have a 2-minute break?
I think we'll just keep going.
Okay.
Let's see. Tom, you had your hand up.
So you talked before about how it's a shame that, you know, somehow career-wise people aren't rewarded for being good communicators. But it seems how somewhat fortunate that hiring decisions and conference invitations aren't made by some faceless masses, they're made by senior mathematicians. So I guess my question is, why don't you put your hiring decisions where your mouth is?
Hire Tom.
So my first question is that a question directed at the panel? And I don't make any hiring decisions myself. They're made with a group of people, and I certainly advocate in a manner that's consistent with what I've been talking about today.
I just want to say I agree with you 100%, but I've made this argument. We had candidates A and B. I'm revealing secrets of University of Chicago hiring, senior hiring. Candidates A and B. Candidate A is superstar communicator, amazing with students, amazing with the public. Candidate B is in the exact same area. Such a bad teacher, you can't even put them in front of an audience. Horrible writer, much narrower, but their L infinity norm is epsilon greater. Okay, they proved a slightly deeper theorem. Several of my colleagues kept making that argument that that's more important. Yeah, I wish I could fire these colleagues.
So let me push back against the premise of the question a little bit, or maybe not so much against the question, but this sort of, as if we all agree that being good at communicating doesn't help your career. I haven't found that to be true. I mean, my first attempt was in writing a textbook, an elementary textbook in nonlinear dynamics for undergraduates, and it was not, a deep thing by any means, but people started to think I was some kind of expert on dynamical systems, which I really wasn't, and I think it helped my career, and then subsequently in writing grant proposals or papers, I think to the extent that they're readable, people read them and cite them, and I'm not the deepest, I'm far from the deepest mathematician. I mean, anyone who knows my math would say that's correct. I'm not a great mathematician, but I do the best with what I've got, and through communicating it, I think it goes a long way. So I think all of us, no matter how good we are mathematically, if you can be the best communicator you can be, it will help in a narrow sense of job, as well as it will help the world.
Karen, I'd like to follow up that question with a slightly related one.
Imagine two candidates at job talks, and you walk out of the first one and you say, boy, that was impressive. I never could have done that. The second one you say, that was so beautiful. Why didn't I think of that? What is your reaction to those scenarios?
That's a really toughie. Sometimes, though, I do want to encourage, because I do want to say for younger people, and I push my students for this all the time. Firstly, one of my former students was like, I'm doing good work, I'm not getting invited to talks. I'm like, just make sure when you're invited, you give a great talk. They gave one great 20-minute talk at an AMS thing. There were people sitting in that audience. Then they were asked to give another talk and another, and now they've been asked to give hundreds of talks. And so every talk is important, give a good talk. Secondly, I know at a university, I know an inside scoop story, there were four candidates who were essentially isomorphic levels. Two of them gave mediocre job talks, one of them gave a horrible one, and one of them hit it out of the park. Who got hired? The guy who hit it out of the park. So it really is, does help.
Maybe I can share with the French situation. So in France, as you may know, we have two disjoint systems. 90% of the mathematicians are professors in university, 10% of mathematicians belong to CNRS, so they have no teaching role at all. I am a CNRS member. And the common idea is that CNRS members should be autistic. if you give good talks, the probability that you are hired by CNRS is close to zero.
Is that how you are hired?
White shirt, that's you.
I'm a normal person who is not a mathematician at all. I'm engaged with high school, and one of my concerns, in a way one of you mentioned this, talking to people and finding out they need to do fractions. I am really upset with the use of calculators because kids don't even know now to line up their decimal points. I'm just wondering at what point what I thought of as mathematics, knowing numbers and that kind of thing, is no longer relevant. And what you guys are doing, mathematics, which is wholly symbolic, begins, and how do those two sort of come together so that people who are in high school will wind up in mathematics as you all think about it?
Quick comment, and it's for all of us. The amazing thing, and I've forgotten about this, is that what we do, it's fancy and stuff, but it does actually connect to what we learned in high school. Like, good mathematics will shed light on, actually, you'll learn something about, yeah. I will just say I'm very proud of the fact that I learned something about the moduli, cohomology of the moduli space of Riemann surfaces, and I realized it was just basically, literally, carrying. Like carrying two numbers and adding 8 plus 5, you have to carry one. I'm happy to explain that. I'm not kidding.
So I just want to say, when I was tutoring these students, I really enjoyed teaching how to add fractions. And when I teach calculus, calculus is one of the greatest intellectual achievements of humanity. It's the first time infinity has ever been taken seriously. And if you don't realize what a privilege it is to teach that, then you're not teaching it right. You're not understanding the opportunity. So I enjoy teaching fractions, and I understand what happens in high school. I had one great teacher in high school, and high school teachers are so important. So I really value you being here. And what I want to say is that mathematics is this tower, and you don't realize how shaky the ground floor is until you try to build the third floor. And that doesn't mean, and what most people do is then they say, okay, I can't do math, or math is too hard for most people. But you just need to go back down and build the ground floor correctly. They're ready now when they're doing calculus to really learn how to add fractions.
Okay, I think we'll take one more question.
So I actually had an interesting conversation with a filmmaker friend, how explaining math is like pitching a movie. And you know, there's some people who are good at pitching movies and some people never get their film made because they don't succeed in getting their mind's picture into somebody else's mind. So a lot of times what people do is they describe it with reference points like, hey, it's a beautiful mind in Sopranos.
Right.
And we know what that is. And so we often do it with math too, just like, you know, it's like carrying meets cohomology. So my question is, how do have the sort of the reference points that we use as mathematicians in talking to each other permeate through a more general population so that we can then use those reference points to describe more interesting things, if that's possible.
For start, making things visual helps, I think, not just in geometry, but in any field. If you can put some sort of image on a screen, just something so that whatever mental picture you have in your mind becomes very explicit for your audience.
I remember that when the great French mathematician Henri Cartan passed away, the even more famous mathematician Jean-Pierre Serre was delivering a lecture, general audience lecture, explaining the work of Cartan. And he wanted to explain the so-called theorems A and B of Cartan, which are vanishing of cohomologies. And he was facing a problem, how to explain cohomology to general audience. And he said, you know, cohomology is the following. You have two things. One is what you can do, and the other one is what you would like to do. Cohomology is the difference between the two. So if you prove that cohomology is zero,
well, in response to that question, the thought that occurs to me is that, you know, if you ask, say, the music department, how do they convey the wonders of the entire history of music, they usually have a kind of music 101 course that gives this basic information to everybody, not with the idea that these are future music majors or musicians, you know? Or I took a course where I learned what Baroque and Rococo painting were. I never had any interest in that, but it was an Art 101. I got to see that. It's very rare to find a university
that has a course intended for everybody about the fantastic achievement of math throughout history, intended for that audience. I mean, I don't know why we don't have that course. I would love to teach that course. I'm sure a lot of us would like to teach that course. And think of what good public relations it would be for us. I mean, including for the future senators that we were worried about. This is the problem. By having our first course be calculus, much as we all, I mean, I don't know if we all, but I certainly love calculus the way that Kurt does, that's not the right course for everybody. We need a Math 101 course that is this Psych 101 or Music 101. I don't know why we don't have it. We should really have that. That would help a lot.
UT Austin does.
UT Austin does have it. Okay, interesting.
Because I believe that Mr. Conway.
Comment, please.
I had the privilege of taking such a course from Bill Thurston and John Conway and Peter Doyle. It's called Geometry and the Imagination. And he would, that's one of the things that, that he did, and it was fantastic.
Yeah, but that's not for the show. That's not for the show.
No,
no. And like, okay, okay.
It's not just for math.
You know what? I wanted to say that it seems to me that the definition of the word general audience is missing.
Right.
We have to be very careful when we give public or public lectures or general audience lectures. This is not well defined. It seems to me that in music, it's easier to define it than in mathematics.
Go ahead.
This time with what Kurt said earlier about how as you give your talk, you can, you know, you look at people and you can tell whether they're following along or getting lost, and you adjust accordingly. One little technical hint on this is, especially if we have a big public talk and there's an AV person there, what they're going to want to do is put a spotlight on you and turn down the house lights. So you have to be really aggressive in not letting them do this and insist that the house lights stay up for the talk.
There is a good joke that, you know, when you give a talk, when I give a talk, I don't mind if people are looking at their watch, but I mind if they shake their hand to see the word.
So I think it's very appropriate to end on a joke.